Right, afternoon, comrades, fellow members of working class. Welcome you to this meeting of in the present series that's course being held here on a Sunday afternoon. This afternoon, Mike Foster from Birmingham will be talking on Marxism, physics and philosophy. Mike's going to be talking for about half an hour or so, after which you'll be able to take part in questions and ask questions and take part in discussion. Okay, I'll like to introduce Mike Foster, who will talk on Marxism, physics and philosophy. Mike.
Right there, good afternoon everyone. Thanks for coming along. It's easy to assume that Marxism and physics complement each other. Both use scientific methods to explain the world in a materialistic way without referring to supernatural or religious accounts. But developments in physics suggest a view of reality which contradicts many assumptions made by Marxists. Indeed, the advances in neuroscience and quantum physics raise questions for all of us, whether Marxists or not, about our origins and even our freedom and our self-defined purpose in life. This talk asks if Marxism really is compatible with the cutting edge of physics. I should point out that this talk's only an introduction to the issue. I won't be going into too much detail, and I'm sure I'll be making some massive simplifications and ignoring other aspects of it all. When I started reading about this, I realised that it would be easy to get way out of my depth, which I probably have done. But I think that the questions I'll be raising are of importance to Marxists, and I'll leave it to others with much more knowledge than me to continue the discussion. We'll start with a reminder of the classic view of what makes up everything around us. Atoms, such as carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and... there you go, that's my incredibly scientific depiction of, of some atoms. So when two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom fit together, you get a water molecule. So two hydrogen and one oxygen makes up a water molecule. And... within this glass of water, there'll be billions, you know, countless numbers of water molecules all making it up. Way too small to be seen with the naked eye, of course. They're in there, though, trust me. And different types of molecules can fit together to make different substances. So sand, for example, is mostly made up of silicon dioxide molecules, also known as silica, mixed with other materials as well. In living organisms, molecules of different types can be grouped together into cells, and cells of the same type are grouped together. So my plant here, my prop, this again, it's all obvious, simple stuff, but you know, we'll start off with some of the basics. So the different parts of a plant are grouped together in different ways. They've got cells which group together in different ways. So the leaves are different to the stalks, which are different to the roots, which are different to the flowers. They're all arrangements of molecules in a slightly different way, and each part of the plant has got its own function in sustaining the organism and to keep the plant alive. They take in water, carbon, light and other nutrients, transform them and use them to self-replicate. In that way, they're like tiny but incredibly complex factories or machines. So organisms like plants can be fairly straightforwardly explained in the same way that we would explain how a machine works. From the simplest components, right down to the atomic or molecular level, right up to the organism and the different parts of the organism as a whole. And scientific developments have applied the same approach to mapping out and explaining the internal systems of more complicated animals as well. You know, plankton is a fairly sort of simple animal which is arguably less complicated than a plant, but also the same way of explaining things is used to explain the internal processes of more complicated animals like insects, birds and mammals. All of their behaviour can be explained in terms of inputs, food, water, sound, textures being used to produce different behavioural outputs. I realise that a plant doesn't sort of behave in the same way that people do. I'm using that as sort of the nearest equivalent term. But if we could take it that, it's sort of being a bit liberal with the language, but the way that plants give off oxygen, you could say that's a sort of behaviour. I'm not suggesting it's deliberate, it's just what the plant does. But with regard to more complicated animals, the process can still be explained in a mechanistic way. For example, an animal recognises the smell of food as being something it can eat, and the sensation of hunger prompts the animal to go and look for food. Or an animal may learn that a certain sound means that a predator is nearby, such as the howling of a wolf, for example. To some extent, these behaviours appear to be hardwired into animals, an inherent part of their makeup. But to some extent, too, these behaviours must have been learnt by the animal at some point in its development. The theory of evolution allows that some hardwired behaviours have come about over generations, rather than being learnt by each individual. An animal's ancestors are those which survive to reproduce, and they survive because they had the right characteristics to allow them to live long enough to reproduce. And those successful characteristics were then passed on to the next generation. So, the behaviour of animals can be explained mechanistically. They're like neat robots, you could say, which respond to sensory inputs with behavioural outputs. And similarly, the way that humans are put together can largely be explained mechanistically. For example, the movement of our arms can be explained by neurons in the brain triggering movement in the muscles and joints. Again, I know this is simplifying things, but it's enough detail for our purposes here. But humans are different to animals, and especially plants, surely. We must be more than just machines. We like to think that we're above other animals because our abilities to think and feel are much, much more sophisticated. We're able to question, believe, love, hate, hope, create in ways that animals can't. We've got self-awareness and empathy with others. An important human ability, and the one which I'll be sort of concentrating most on later on, is the ability to consciously choose to have free will. And the result of all of these abilities is that we have developed languages, culture, and technology. Surely, if humans were just basically the same as machines, then we wouldn't have all these abilities and achievements. But ironically, our investigations in science and technology have led us to question whether those investigations have really been the product of conscious and deliberate thought. Neuroscience, in particular, has caused scientists and philosophers to doubt whether we really do have free will. There was a series of experiments arranged by Benjamin Libet, I think I've pronounced that correctly, in the 1970s and 1980s. And again, here's one of my hastily produced illustrations. Volunteers, that's a volunteer there, they were asked to perform a simple task, such as pressing a button. They were wired up to an EEG machine. That's what I'm hoping an EEG machine looks like. And what they do is they measure the activity in the brain. So when the volunteers were asked to press a button, they were also asked to have a look at the exact time that they pressed the button. I'm guessing it was much more sophisticated than just a clock like that. It would have gone down to the precise millisecond. So they were asked to press the button and note the exact time that they pressed it. But they're asked to focus on the moment when they formed the conscious act of willing in their head, when they actually decided that would be the exact time to press the button. They weren't given a time to press the button. They said, within a 5-minute window or something like that, perhaps. So what the EEG machine did, it recorded the exact time that the button was pressed, and that was compared with the time that the person felt that they had the conscious decision to press the button. On average, it took 200 milliseconds from conscious willing to the hand pressing the button. But it was found out that the processes in the brain responsible for the hand moving to press the button started 500 milliseconds before the button was pressed. This means that the process which ends with pressing the button started 300 milliseconds before the volunteers were conscious of deciding to press it. This implies that consciously deciding to press the button was not the cause of the button being pressed. In other words, moving the hand was an unconscious event, not caused by free will. An objection to this conclusion comes from pointing out that the volunteers had to recognise the time when they made the decision. Perhaps the act of noting the time accounts for the apparent lateness of the conscious decision to press the button. Maybe the conscious decision really did come before the brain processes started to move the hand, but noting the time delayed its recognition slightly. And of course here we're talking about milliseconds, so it's quite an exact science. However, this experiment has been replicated many times using much more accurate and sophisticated equipment than was around in the 70s and 80s. And the same result has kept coming up. It seems as if the decision to press the button wasn't what caused the button to be pressed. And a related experiment from 2008 claimed that it was possible to predict with 60% accuracy whether volunteers would press a button with their left or their right hand, up to 10 seconds before the volunteer became aware of having made that choice. But, you know, in hindsight, being able to predict this 60% of the time isn't all that impressive, as, you know, guesswork would have meant that you got it right 50% of the time, so it's only like a 10% margin. But having said that, quite a few neuroscientists have sort of latched onto these findings as apparent proof that we don't really have free will. At most, these experiments show that apparently deliberate events in the brain happen unconsciously as a result of a mechanistic process of sensory inputs and learnt or hardwired behaviour. So again, it apparently confirms that we're machines in much the same way that animals or lesser animals or plants are. And of course as well, the smaller cells, molecules and atoms which make up the internal organs which have all these functions and processes, they too can be explained mechanistically. So this could lead to the conclusion that we have no free will. We're just machines whose behaviour can be explained in deterministic causal chains. Even without taking part in formal experiments like Libet's, or if we doubt their accuracy, we can still recognise that some decisions aren't as conscious as we like to think that they are. For example, normal everyday speech normally happens too quickly for us to consciously decide what to say, let alone making conscious decisions to, you know, move our lips, breathe in, breathe out. You know, a lot happens without us really being aware of it. When we're having a conversation, the words just tumble out without us really choosing what to say. Next, well, that's the excuse I like to use anyway when I've said something embarrassingly crass. But I can't really use that excuse if anyone rips my talk to shreds because I've needed to make quite detailed notes. So, I don't trust myself in that way to do a talk like this spontaneously because I suppose doing this talk made me aware that there's always the problem of not choosing what we say because speech normally happens too quickly for us to stop and think. Also as well, we realise that we're not fully in control of what we do when we experience cravings, especially if someone's addicted to something, or when certain hormones are released. Anyone who's in shock or frightened or sexually aroused doesn't seem to be consciously in control of everything that they do. Again, that's my excuse. So, the implications of Libet's experiments have suggested to some scientists and philosophers that we don't deliberately control anything that we do. When they deny that we have free will, they say that conscious decisions are just a byproduct or an after effect of the important unconscious processes in the brain. They would say that our conscious decisions don't really cause our actions, they just correlate with them. Some scientists have taken an even stronger version of this view and have argued that free will isn't the only cherished belief that neuroscience says that we should abandon. Alex Rosenberg, in particular, has argued that explaining people mechanistically also means that we have to abandon such everyday notions such as purpose and meaning. How can lumps of matter have a purpose or a meaning? Thinking that we can attribute meanings to things is, in his view, just a misinterpretation of the way that we process sensory inputs and our behavioural outputs. When we think about something, we're just making associations based on either sort of hardwired functions or learned behaviour. And again, learned behaviour can be explained sort of mechanistically for anyone who's aware of the experiments with Pavlov's dogs in triggering off salivation when a bell was sounded, whereas salivation would normally only be triggered off by the smell of food. So for people who take this very strong scientific determinist view, thought is just a biological process and shouldn't be dressed up in almost mystical concepts like purpose and meaning. Instead, so in Rosenberg's view, the humanities and social sciences, and this includes, you know, history, economics, anything like that, just uses the wrong framework for explaining things by relying on these concepts. Instead, Rosenberg says that these, you know, the humanities and the social sciences should just be regarded as entertainment rather than anything which really has predictive or scientific merit. In his view, physics contains all of the facts, that's all of them, big capital letters, all the facts we need to know about reality, and any so-called facts produced by economics or history have no relevance, as I say, apart from any enjoyment we might get. This strict, deterministic, mechanistic view is backed up by a lot of science. Explaining the brain as a machine is just an extension of the way that we've been explaining and proving other aspects of ourselves and our environment. But so, at the very least, developments in neuroscience confirm that some of the mental processes which make up actions we think are the result of free will aren't conscious at all. But developments in neuroscience aren't the only way that science has cast doubt on the existence of free will. The role of randomness in nature also has implications for our belief. And perhaps oddly, the role of randomness in science came out of research using mathematics. The mechanistic way which neuroscience explains what goes on in our brains is similar to the way that mathematics has been used to explain nature. Often the mathematical explanation comes first, and then it's sort of confirmed by empirical evidence. For example, the motions of the planets and the existence of subatomic particles were first explained mathematically. Regular patterns in nature, such as the motion of planets, can be described as mathematical patterns. We've worked out that the orbits of the planets repeatedly follow the same path around the sun, so we can use maths to explain and predict their movement. And because they follow a regular pattern, they are analogous to the mechanistic way that machines work. Since the work of Alan Turing in the 1950s, it's been increasingly accepted that life can also be explained through mathematical formulae. Turing was the first to relate maths to how cells in an embryo develop. The problem for those who followed Turing was to explain how the featureless group of identical cells making up the embryo could spontaneously change their form and clump together. This is how an embryo grows into cells which will later form skin, bones and all the different internal organs. A massively complicated organism somehow grows from this initial tiny clump of featureless cells. Previously, it was accepted that nature obeyed mechanistic laws, such as I've explained. But this kind of spontaneous growth from regularity suggested that randomness has some part to play. The precise way in which different types of cells grow from a uniform group of them appeared to be down to chance to some extent. And so began chaos theory. For these purposes, chaos can be defined as how a mathematically describable system is capable of being unpredictable without outside influence. This implies that determined systems can have undetermined outcomes. The weather is a good metaphor here. We can map out wind patterns, the location of the sun in relation to the Earth and so on, but we can never exactly predict the way that the weather will turn out. We don't know exactly how fast the wind will blow or the exact time that rain will start falling. And I'm sure anyone who got caught up in the recent showers will be reminded of how unpredictable the weather can be. So the scientific consensus now is that mathematically determined patterns coexist in nature with unpredictable randomness. And randomness is also found in the behaviour of subatomic particles. Right, so, you know, remember my incredibly detailed and scientifically accurate drawing of a water molecule and its atoms there. So remember that all of the cells in our brains and bodies are made up of molecules, atoms, and ultimately subatomic particles. You know, atoms themselves are made up of a nucleus and orbiting electrons. But these subatomic particles don't behave in the more predictable way that atoms and molecules and their larger groupings do. There was some research which became known as the double slit experiment. This dates back as far back as the beginning of the 19th century and was revised and repeated throughout the 20th century. This proved that subatomic particles can move around in apparently random ways. But the experiment also showed that single particles behave in the same way as waves of particles do. And what this means is that a single subatomic particle acts in the same way that a group of particles do. But to do this, it would seem that a single particle would have to be in more than one place at the same time. This is counterintuitive, and it contradicts the fundamental assumptions behind more mechanistic science. So the fundamental particles which make up all of the cells in our brains and bodies somehow don't obey the same laws that the cells themselves do. Now, if we apply this to human thought, then it suggests that there are some random or unpredictable influences among all the mechanistic explanations given by neuroscience. And again, this threatens our belief in free will. How can we really be free if our mechanistic brains are ultimately made of things which behave unpredictably and have done since we were conceived? And perhaps conditions like epilepsy or migraines are the result of being particularly vulnerable to random occurrences in the brain. But there's the objection that what may appear to us or appear to scientists as random isn't really random at all. Perhaps we just don't yet know how all of the factors fit together. We might just be using words like random or unpredictable to cover up the gaps in our knowledge. But if our collective knowledge increases and we can really describe everything mechanistically without referring to chance, then we're faced with the same problem as before. If everything can be explained mechanistically, doesn't that mean that there's no room for free will as well as chance? Another way around the problem of quantum randomness threatening our free will is to argue that anything which happens at the quantum or the subatomic level is too small to affect things at the cellular, at the higher levels. And we can use an analogy to explain this. When water boils, the molecules are excited, so they jiggle around excitedly and rapidly and randomly. But this randomness is still contained by the molecular bonds which hold the water together. Similarly, random or unpredictable occurrences on the quantum level are contained by the systems that they occur in. And this view also gets around a contradiction between the two main arguments against free will that I've covered so far. Together, these two branches of science that I've discussed seem to be suggesting that at the quantum level, everything is chaotic and random and unpredictable. But at the level of atoms and above, everything is determined. How can these two approaches be compatible? So instead, we could say that there isn't a contradiction because anything above the atomic level is too big to be affected by quantum indeterminacy. Now, religious or spiritual people can sidestep all these issues fairly easily. Too easily, in my opinion. They could say that free will is a property of the mind or the soul. And the soul, being non-physical, doesn't have to obey the normal rules of physics. So mechanistic determinism isn't relevant, and nor is quantum randomness. The view that the mind and the body are separate is called dualism. But the main problem with this view is how the mind and the body could possibly interact if they were made of completely different stuff. And obviously the mind and the body does interact. So again, there's a problem for dualists in interaction between the mind and the body. But despite the obvious objections to dualism, it's a very widespread assumption. Even people who aren't religious are tempted to assume that there's a difference between the mind and our physical body, because this view has become ingrained in our society. For example, we're familiar with the science fiction idea that someone's personality can swap from one body to another. There's a film called Freaky Friday, which is a trashy Disney film, but it's quite watchable. But the point is that the plot of the film, a mother and a daughter's minds swap bodies with hilarious consequences. And there's a similar one called Big, where the mind of a child is in an adult's body. Now, I'm not saying that anyone thinks that this is possible. The point is that the notion of your mind somehow existing in a different body only makes sense if dualism is assumed. But the assumption that dualism, that the mind is separate from the body, has implications for what we believe and how we behave. A recent study from the University of Cologne concluded that dualists were less likely to take care of themselves. People with a dualist way of thinking were less likely to agree with statements like, I regularly go to the gym, or I limit the amount of fat that I eat. Presumably they assume that you don't really need to look after your body because your mind isn't a part of it. I'm not a dualist, but I don't regularly go to the gym and I don't limit the amount of fat that I eat. So it doesn't imply that materialists always do think about their health and well-being. But on a wider scale, this could suggest that dualists are less likely to care about the environment or even society. Why bother too much with physical earthly concerns when our fundamental selves aren't connected with this? So, any Marxists who assume that the mind is somehow a different thing to the brain should think more about how science rules this out. So, if a Marxist rejects the dualist position because of its religious or spiritual baggage, then what conclusions could they reach about issues like free will or their self-determined purpose in life? If the Marxist goes along with some of the conclusions made by science about how the brain works in a mechanistic way, can they still accept that we have free will? Well, Marxism is compatible with science in that both use the same methods, empirical research and testable theories underpinned by mathematics. And both Marxism and science share the goal of explaining things without referring to supernatural or non-physical explanations. They're both materialist theories, although they use a slightly different definition of the word materialism. Marxist philosophy starts from the premise that the world around us isn't something objective or external which we can study as if we're outside. As we're part of the world, we interact with it rather than just observe it. And this is one of the meanings of Marx's famous quote, the philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways, the point is to change it. Now, I know that this quote isn't usually interpreted in this way, but that's because it's being taken out of context. The usual meaning of this quote is that there's little point in sitting around theorising about society. It's much more important to go out and do something about it. And I want to emphasise that Marx does mean this as well. But as he wrote it, it came at the end of his 11 short theses on Feuerbach. And this is probably the most famous part of his early, more philosophical writings. These works form the philosophical foundations of his later economic writings, and therefore they shouldn't be seen as, this is a personal opinion, they should be seen as less important than what's in Das Kapital. So when the quote, the philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways, the point is to change it, appears, it's after a discussion on how Marx thinks scientific explanations can ignore the vital role of human experience. After all, scientific explanations wouldn't be there in the first place if people weren't around to come up with them. So Marx deliberately, in my opinion, gave a double meaning to his quote. The more well-known meaning, and the meaning that the truth isn't an abstract thing to be studied. We make the truth. The second thesis on Feuerbach expands on this notion. The question whether objective truth can be attributed to human thinking is not a question of theory, but it is a practical question. Humanity must prove the truth, i.e. the reality and power, the this-sidedness of his thinking in practice. The dispute over the reality or non-reality of thinking that is isolated from practice is a purely scholastic question. So Marx is saying that practical action is part of the way to reach the truth. It can't be separated from it. And here, practical action must surely mean conscious, deliberate action. Thinking and deliberate action are inseparable. This means that free will is a part of being human for the Marxist. We can't accept the conclusion that explaining our actions mechanistically rules out free will. Somehow we've got to reconcile the two. Funnily enough, Marx's view that human free will is a fundamental part of life is echoed by some aspects of quantum physics. This next bit might be a bit tenuous, so if anyone wants to say that there's not really a connection, I'll be glad to hear any objections. Remember that I said that subatomic particles don't obey the same scientific laws as atoms, molecules and larger clumps of matter. And I mentioned the double slit experiment, which showed that particles behave as both single particles and as waves of particles. So the way this experiment was set up, it involved firing single particles, such as photons or electrons, through two slits. The particles would pass through the slits onto a surface behind them, and scientists observed the behaviour of the particles by the traces they left behind. But when a detector was placed by the slits, the behaviour of the particles changed. It was as if the presence of an observer affected what the particles would do. And this could imply that human interaction is part of what reality fundamentally is. Some scientists have expanded on this possibility, and it's often called the strong anthropic principle, or the participatory anthropic principle, which I don't know all that much about. But names to remember here include John Archibald Wheeler, John Barrow, and Frank J. Tipler. So there is some scientific backup to Marxist assumptions. The important bit is that Marxism is a practical theory. It is a theory about how the world changes by human action. For Marxists, the physical world is always open to manipulation by people living, working, producing, consuming, experiencing. This is the ongoing process by which society changes. And it's a physical process too, as it can be observed and measured in scientific ways. So perhaps the Marxist proof that we have free will is in our development of society. If humans lacked free will, then I think that our limited mental capabilities would lead to a very limited sort of society. Nothing as near as complex as society is. Perhaps if humans lacked free will, our societies could only, or we could only exist in the same way that ants or bees do. Their societies are rigid, with every member having a set determined role. But human society is dynamic. We don't have set roles, even though capitalism likes to make us think as if we do. Human society is always changing and developing, and I can't see how it can do that without us having free will. And hopefully it's through free will, rather than mechanistic, unconscious processes or quantum randomness, that I've reached this conclusion. Thank you.